Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very much for joining me today. I just finished talking with Ellen Widmer about her new book, Fiction's Family, John Shi, John Kai, and the Business of Women in Late Qing China. This came out with Harvard University Press in 2016. And as you can already hear from the title, this is a book that is about many different kinds of historical objects at the same time. It's a book that follows a particular family. John Shi and John Kai are brothers that are part of this larger unit. And the book looks at their parents, it looks at some of their children, and it looks at the importance of and the nature of their family linkages over the course of the chapters of the book that you'll hear us talk about in the conversation to come. It's also about the relationship between family and fiction. And one of the things that you'll hear us talking a lot about is kind of the nature of the kind of work that it takes to understand fiction as part of history, to try to study fiction as part of history, and the ways that the particular kinds of sources and the ways of creating a conversation among those sources that Ellen uses in the book, they're very, very interesting, I think, for any of us who are in the business of or who are interested in the process of telling stories about and with the past. It's also in particular about the attitudes of both of these major men, both of these brothers, John Shi and John Kai, to issues of gender and reform, women as objects, women as subjects, women as readers, women as writers in the late Qing period. And so this is a book that I think is going to be of wide interest to anyone interested in or working in the history of gender, in particular, the history of women and gender in the modern period and in the late Qing in China in particular. So there's a lot here. It's a really fascinating study, and I will let you get to the conversation. And just to say, thanks very, very much for your support of the channel, for listening, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Ellen Widmer about her new book, Fiction's Family. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Ellen, and thanks so much for making time to talk with me today and for giving us a great book to talk about. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So let's start with the traditional question for the podcast. What brought you to the study of China, and why the fiction and the drama of China in particular as your area of academic study?
Oh, this is a hard one for me.
I know. It's a huge question.
I don't know. Well, I was just in Russia for the European Association of Chinese Studies meeting, and remembered at that time that many years ago, as an undergraduate, I had been interested in Russia. I had no way of studying Chinese at that point because there wasn't any at my college. But I had gotten very interested in Russia and gone on to take 3 years. And the meeting I just went to was in Russia, and all that came flowing back. But what happened subsequently is that I married my husband, who I'm no longer married to, but he was in East Asia. And really, I just trotted along behind him as he went off to write his dissertation in Taiwan. And I was completely captivated by it. And by then I already had two kids and this and that, but it was a very strange odyssey, but that's where I ended up.
So the book that we're talking about today follows what you call fiction's family, right? This is the title of the book. And you describe in the first chapter the three different reference that fiction's family has in the book. There's a particular family of two figures who we'll talk about at some length in the hour to come, Wang Qingdi and John Sizong. And then their sons, two in particular, who also were writers. So there's that family. There's also a fictional family from one of the sons' novels, and also a family, if in quotes, of genres that helped shape the novels of the other sons. So there's a lot of ways of thinking about family in this context and its relationship to fiction. And the book focuses on one particular group of people in order to do that work. So this is all as a preface to ask, how did you come to this particular project and why these particular figures as a focus for this monograph?
As I say in my acknowledgments, a lot of it had to do with my advisor, Patrick Hannon at Harvard, and he was interested in the older of the two sons. He was not interested in the parents or the younger son. But it was through that beginning that I started looking around. I just wanted to know more about the area that they lived in, which was not Shanghai. I'm used to thinking of the late Qing in terms of Shanghai, and this was somehow going to be a late Qing project. But having it set in Chuzhou made it interesting to me. So I just followed along. It's sort of beginning with my advisor's footsteps, but then I took it well beyond what he had intended in his own work. And he told me, fortunately, that he didn't intend to go any farther with it, so that left me a clear field.
Great. So let's actually get right into it then. We've already talked a little bit about the fact that there are some main figures that anchor this study. And in the first chapter, we briefly meet them, and we'll talk a lot about them in the chapters to come, or a lot more. One of the figures is Wang Qingdi. Now, she is a wife in a marriage relationship that we'll talk about, and she had published a collection of poems known as Collected Poems and Songs from Weaving Cloud Tower. So for listeners who have never heard of her, can you tell us a little bit about her? What do we need to know about her as a figure in order to set the stage for understanding what's going to be important about her in the book?
You know, I had spent a lot of time in my career studying traditional writers, women writers of the upper classes. That's a whole other area of my work, quite apart from the fiction and drama emphasis. And she was very much that. She was very much an upper class woman, although living in a remote part of China. Two or three things at least stood out for me with her. One was that she lived through the Taiping Rebellion, which was a horrific time for many women, and many women committed suicide because they felt they had been violated sexually, or they were afraid they might be violated sexually. She didn't suffer that experience, but she left poems about what it was like to go through the Taiping Rebellion, and that stood out in my mind. Another big thing for me, well, apart from the fact of her two sons, was the her interest. I couldn't believe it when I finally found it. Her interest in publishing in new style publications. So Shunbao, being a modern, modern for its day publication, put out in Shanghai starting in 1872, carries. Shunbao itself does not, but the supplements to that newspaper carry some of her poems. And I found that quite extraordinary because I didn't know of any woman in that conservative mindset that would have wanted to publish in new style publications. But I did find out subsequently that there were quite a few. There were actually quite a few that went from their conservative state of being before the journal began to publish into a mode of publishing in that way. But I hadn't thought it was possible. I had no idea. So I think those two are probably the most outstanding. Well, and thirdly, a point I emphasize quite a bit in the book is that she seemed to be very unhappy. Mm-hmm. In the public in the poems that she published, you don't get that. She was very upbeat in those poems, but or else she was mourning the death of somebody else, but she wasn't really talking about herself. But in the poems that she talks about herself, there is a good deal of unhappiness, particularly because if I judged correctly, because her husband was absent quite a bit, and that seemed to be a big problem for her. And when you look at his poems in juxtaposition, he too suffered a good deal from the Taiping Rebellion and many other things, but he managed to sort of leave Chuzhou and go off to other parts of China and have a lovely time with his friends. So it didn't seem entirely parallel. So those were the three things that caught my eye.
Right. Excellent. So this is already taking us really nicely into the first couple of chapters in the book. And I just want to pull some of the threads that you've already mentioned in just even talking about Wang. So you've mentioned the importance of Chuzhou as a locality, and this becomes really, really important throughout the book. And you talk about this a whole lot, and we'll return to it over the course of the chapters. Is there anything in particular that you'd like listeners to understand about Chuzhou as a locality, right? And this becomes important not just because of the geographical nature of Chuzhou, or the understanding Chuzhou as a geographical space, but it helps us, I think, also, just again, from the perspective of one reader, to understand the way you're using locality in the book, right? The family is a locality, Chuzhou is a locality. So can you talk a little bit about, for you, what's important about Chuzhou as a locality and in relation to how you're thinking about and using locality in the book?
Chuzhou is a backwater, and it's upriver from Shanghai. It takes 10 days to get by boat, 10 days to get from Chuzhou to Shanghai. And that means, in addition just to having it be far away, that developments that are taking place in Shanghai, such as the end of foot binding, do not take place in Chuzhou until quite a bit later. And you can see all of that unfolding in the daughter of one of the two brothers that writes fiction, when she talks about exactly that, how far behind Chuzhou was from the rest of, not from the rest of China, really, but from Shanghai, which was the leader. Mm-hmm. I think you could say, we could really say that Chuzhou is more typical and Shanghai is more atypical, or Chuzhou is more Chinese and Shanghai is more international. We could put it in those terms. But for the two young men growing up, it was very tempting to leave Chuzhou and go to Shanghai, and which both of them did. The older of the two eventually came back home to Chuzhou, whereas the younger one stayed in Shanghai for the rest of his life. But the juxtaposition of the two cities was very interesting to me. Even when one of them lived in Shanghai, he would go back to Chuzhou. And even when he was staying in Chuzhou, he might go back to Shanghai. The both brothers carried the two locations in their hearts and minds throughout my acquaintance with them.
Now, one of the things, or another thing that you mentioned that I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about, has to do with something that is really, really strikingly important throughout the book, and that is the way that you're using your source base to tell this story. It's really interesting. I think there's a lot of there's a lot to be learned for readers from how you're using your sources, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that. So you talked about Wang being relatively unhappy. And in the second chapter, you talk about the context of her marriage, right? Her husband having left at some point. And it seems like in the course of their marriage, there's a kind of initial adjustment period, as you put it, some good times in what seems to have been a kind of companionate marriage, and then lots of not so good times, right? Jen leaves for a post away from Wang, and the marriage seems to have deteriorated. Now, we know this in part from reading their poems. And this is a really interesting, I think, methodological point of engagement that we can talk about, in part because it's not at all self-evident how one reads a poetical corpus for evidence of biographical information, right? This is something that's, I think, a really interesting methodological problem. So what I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, is how you worked with the surviving poems of both husband and wife in order to get at some way of understanding their marriage, their states of mind, and really their biographical kind of backgrounds here?
That's a very complicated question, and it would take me a long time to answer it well. But in brief, each one of them had two stages in publication. In Wang Qingdi's case, she did publish her poems as they stood as of 1857. And then she, as far as I know anyway, she didn't publish any more poems, except the ones that she published in Shenbao and its associated journals. But others did survive, and a family member much, much later in the 1960s copied them all down by hand. And I noticed a distinct shift between the poems in the first printed collection and the ones that were hand-copied by the relative. They sounded fairly upbeat. There was lots on the children, even though it was a rough time with the Taipings coming and going. It was a family time, and that seemed to be what she wanted. It's in the later poems that she talks a good deal about the loneliness of her cottage all off by itself, or the rain on the wutong trees and that kind of thing. She sounded terribly alone. Once in a while, you see a poem to her. She didn't write any surviving poems to her younger son, but to the older son, there are several poems, and those sound maybe a bit happier. But it's in that division between the first set of poems and the second that I came up with this hypothesis about the marriage. Then when you look at the husband's poems, his publication history is rather similar. He has a published collection that may have actually come out in parallel with hers around the same time, but I think it was a little later, 1860. And that is a longer collection of poems, and they're also a lot more difficult than hers. I couldn't read many of them. I really couldn't read by myself. I needed help. And then by a lot of sleuthing, I did find a whole second collection of his poems that had been written. There should altogether be 10 sections, and right now all I have is 8. It's the 5 and 6 that are missing, but I don't think I'm missing that much. The last 4 sections were miscataloged in a library in China, and I figured that out eventually, and thanks very much to the help of a colleague at Fudan, I was able to get a copy. And It's almost the inverse of her poems in that the first published set are full of despair about his career and about the Taipings and whatever else. And the second set are really rather fun. He's having a good time with a lot of his friends. So it was by putting sort of A and B together in each of the two cases that I came up with the hypothesis.
Great. So understanding the parents' work and sort of the parents' relationship as we can glean it from this work becomes really important later on in the book, because it's used as background to understand the work of their sons. Now, the book uses the broad range of these sons' writings, and these are 2 of 7 children that this couple had, in order to contextualize their reformist works, and it uses the novel of one of them to understand the fiction of the other, among other things. So this is a really interesting method in juxtaposing and putting into conversation different kinds of sources at different, not only generic, but also epistemic levels, in order to create this story. Throughout the book, you talk about the nature of the sources that you used to understand this this network, right? The relationships between these different kinds of families that emerge from these works. So let's talk a little bit about that, because I think as we were talking before we started recording, you were saying this book is as much about the sources, right, as it is about these families. Mm-hmm. For you, what are the particular strengths and challenges of the working of this source base? And were there any particular moments or especially notable aspects of these sources that stick out for you in the research process?
Again, it's a complicated question.
Full of those.
That's all right. That's all right. That's all right. One thing we have to remember is that the older brother is 12 years younger than the younger brother. So he's not a generation older, but let's say half a generation. And it's funny, though, in the older brother's case, we actually have somewhat better material about him. He has the one novel that contains a family very much like his own, one that goes through the Taiping Rebellion. And for him, the Taiping Rebellion is the sort of moment of awakening when the characters realize how bad some of the old Chinese habits were, the examination system, the bound foot, and opium. Those three things are all he realizes all of those things, and his family maybe is an exaggeration of his own family. We have no proof at all that opium was a factor in the real family, but in the fictional family it was. Who knows what the real reality was? But in the older brother's case, what was really helpful, well, first of all, he had written one other sort of unpublished narrative about a kind of a massacre of an official in connection with the Boxer Rebellion. And that gives some insight into his thoughts and his life. And it contextualizes the fiction, too, because it shows how idealistic the fiction is. The monograph on the massacre was not idealistic at all. It was never published. But the local history was of great use to me for both of the brothers, but particularly the older brother, because after a while in his life and his career, the older brother gave up his life in Shanghai, went back to Chuzhou, even though he did return sometimes. He went back and lived in Chuzhou. And there's a good deal about him in the local history. He was an important local educator, and we can find out quite a bit about it. I learned from all of that how to read a local history. It's not so easy. You have to have the story of a person's life is broken up and it's sort of distributed among many sections. So that was, I mean, the story of Zhang Xi, the older brother, is his novel and his writing about the massacre, but in large measure to do with what the local history had to say about it. And then beyond that, there were some writings of two of his children, both of whom were progressives, and that added to what I had to say about him. All of that only added up to one chapter, and I had ended up with three chapters on John Kai, the younger brother, and I've just finished telling you how there wasn't very much about him in the local history, right. which there wasn't. But I was able to put together a few things. He did write some sketches of the courtesan quarters, several of them. Those were probably the best and most interesting source about him. I didn't really have much material from local history. I had some, just a little bit. The younger brother too, had helped his brother to found schools and, among other things, to kick monks out of their temples. They needed places to have their schools, so they would think of pretexts. For example, the monks were drowning girls or something like that, and they would kick the monks out and take the building over for the school. That kind of thing he did help with. But it was mostly his novels, of which there were basically three that I worked on, and that told me a fair amount about him. But I think much more the courtesan sketches, because there he talks about himself, his life in Shanghai, his life with the courtesans, and his various thoughts on foot binding and things like that. Then sort of miraculously, and this has to do with internet searching, I discovered that he also was a journalist for a newspaper in Hankou. And that was a city completely different from the other two. He was not Shanghai and not Chuzhou. Here he is in Hankou. And he's talking there in his editorials and his other pieces about himself as if he were a native of Hankou, which I found rather amusing when he wasn't at all. But in any case, it was I don't think that material from Hankou really added very much biographically, but it gave some sense of what his views were, I guess.
Great. So the book actually includes a chapter on each one of these kinds of materials that John Kai, this younger brother, produced. And we'll talk about those briefly in turn. There's a chapter on his life in courtesan sketches. There's a chapter that looks at his novels. And there's a chapter that looks at him as a journalist. And one of the really interesting things, or rather interesting points that I think you're making here in the course of these chapters, is that there's no... you can learn a lot when you juxtapose these kinds of materials that you don't have access to if you're just looking at one kind of source. But at the same time, there's no real Jiang Kai, right? There's no real singular, complete picture of a person that comes out of even this juxtaposition. So there's some, again, interesting methodological points that come out and conceptual points that come out of the way that you're using sources, and I think a really, really interesting way. So let's get into the brothers. We've talked a little bit about the parents, the family, and we've introduced the brothers a little bit, but let's get into them in more detail. Chapter 3 focuses on Jiang Qi, the eldest son of this couple and the eldest son of their 7 children. Now, it looks at not just his life, but also his writings, and it focuses on his only novel, Love Among the Courtesans. This is a novel that, among other things, reflects upon some social evils, right? Or as the book calls them, social evils, opium, bound feet, and the 8-legged essay being among the most prominent. So for listeners, can you introduce this novel since it's so prominent in the analysis of the book? What's for you most important for us to understand about the nature of this novel and the work that it does for us in understanding something about this brother?
Well, and here I go back to the work of Patrick Hannon, who, before I began anything on the project, noted that that novel had been written for a fiction contest that had been organized by a Western missionary, John Fryer, in Shanghai. And there, it, as it happens, now some other novels from that contest have turned up. I think quite a few have turned up in Berkeley, in the library in Berkeley. But I don't know, I know very little about the other ones. But the terms of the contest were that what any novel submitted had to go, had to raise doubts or had to critique the three things you just mentioned, the opium, the bound foot, and the 8-legged essay. And what I found interesting about that is that Jiang Qi manages his novel was written in 1897, and the Taiping Rebellion had been many decades earlier, but somehow Jiang Kai manages to switch the time around so that it's practically a contemporary novel of his own day on why these three things are wrong. But the reason, as I've sort of said earlier, the reason they turn out to be wrong is because of the Taiping Rebellion, which establishes, well, if you take the case of women, that they can't run away from the Taipings, and it's only women with unbound feet, such as maids, who can actually run away. So that makes a clear point in favor of unbound feet. And then there'll be somebody is consuming opium all the time and can't function in another way. The Taipings, what is kind of ironic is the Taipings themselves were against all of these evils. So that it's, the Taipings were very much against opium. But it was a trick that Jiang Qi had to play to make it seem as though, even though he opposed the Taipings, he also opposed the three evils. Anyway, he pulled it all off. And the novel makes sense. And I don't know what else to say about it. Was there something else I should say?
Oh, no. I was going to actually just follow up by just kind of asking you to talk a little bit about deriving biographical information from the novel, right? This is something that you actually talk about. You tell us here in this chapter, right, that he's using his own family history to inform his novel's treatment of family. Yeah. And we see how the concerns of his novel are later extended into other work that he's doing in the field of education later. So I would just like to hear a little bit about what you think about using a novel, or this novel in particular, as that kind of source, in terms of your process and the methodology and the particular challenges there.
I don't claim that the novel in the family in the novel mm-hmm. truly represents his own family in every way. I don't think so, because or I think it might be the case, but I just have no way of knowing. But by looking at the poems that his parents wrote while the Taiping Rebellion was underway, and also in looking at poems that his father wrote about his very young son, the same person who later wrote this novel at a young age, who could write so well, I think there is reason to project, and that's all I try to do. I don't insist that I'm right about how the family in the novel relates to the real family. But I just attempted to project what I thought must be going on. I also think that the sense of terror about the Taipings that comes across in Zhang Xi's novel has a lot of resonance with the sense of terror that one finds in the parents' poems about that event, especially the mothers. I think that there's got to be some correlation there. He was old enough. I don't remember now exactly, but he was something like 8 maybe when the Taipings came and they went. That was the other thing. They would come. Just a tiny point, but we look at our history books and we're told the Taiping Rebellion went from X to Y. But from the point of view of this family, there were rumors that they might be coming. And so then they would flee. They would flee to a nearby village, or they would flee to Hangzhou or something. And then it would turn out they weren't coming after all. So they go back home. But the long series of years where the Taipings might come or might not come, or when even after they'd been defeated, there were still remnants of them around who were still dangerous. A lot of that comes out in the novel and seems to be a parallel to what we find in the parents' poems. That I would not go so far as to say that I absolutely am sure that I deduced a close correlation between the fictional family and the real family. I think that was only, I tried to make it very clear. I didn't know for sure what I was talking about, but I thought I would give it a try. I mean, for example, Wang Qingdi had a very successful father. He'd done very well on the examinations. And in the novel, the father is not the wife's father, but it's the husband's father. So there's a lot of switching that went around. But I think a family with a strong patriarch in residence could be a parallel between the fictional group and Zhang Xi's own family.
I mean, this is actually one of the things that I really appreciated about the book, is that you do make it very, very clear throughout that you're not saying X caused Y, right? You're not saying, and the book is very, very clear about that. And I think for me, and I think for listeners and readers perhaps who are interested in historiography and methodology and how we tell the stories that we tell, this is one of the real contributions of the book, is that it's giving us a way and a model, right, for thinking about and practicing how to tell a story by looking for resonances and parallels and correlations. And it's very, very clear, just to underline what you just said, that you're not saying explicitly, this definitely caused that. And that's actually, right, I think, one of the reasons it's so interesting and so kind of methodologically fruitful to think with. So in the context of looking at Zhang Xi, we also learn a little bit about what happened, as I just mentioned, after he writes this novel. He becomes a leading proponent of new style education in Chuzhou. And you talk also in this chapter, and I'll just mention this, and then we can move on to the other brother, about the way his educational reform, extended the concerns that he was writing about in his novel, and about the way, in turn, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, the work of his children in turn extended the concerns that we see of his life. Both of them are really formative in the natural foot movement. One of them founds Chuzhou's first natural foot society, and the daughter that I think you mentioned a little bit before is also very active in this movement. So again, there's a lot more in this chapter that readers will find if they're particularly interested in this figure. But then we move to the set of three chapters about the other brother. This is the third son, Zhang Kai. Chapters 4 through 6 focus on him. Now, you talk here about the fact that he uses lots of pen names, so it's actually kind of difficult to find out a whole lot about him, right? We know apparently next to nothing about his own family, right? Except that he didn't marry. Is that right?
No, he did marry. The father has one letter to him about having married, and I don't know, but the wife doesn't seem to be there by the time he gets to Shanghai. I don't know what's going on.
Okay. But we know very little about his family.
Right.
Now, one of the interesting, again, methodological things that comes out of the treatment of Zhang Kai is that it becomes very clear that methods of book history, looking very carefully at covers and seals on some books, become a really important way to derive authorship from some of these works. And then by extension, to put them into conversation as works of Zhang Kai, and as works that are informing the broader story. So, three cheers for book history here. I put a plug in for that. Okay, so chapter 4 introduces both what we know about his life, but also what we know about his courtesan sketches.
Right.
Okay. So let's just kind of dive into that. What are courtesan sketches for listeners who may not be familiar with that kind of a text, a genre? And you talk about some of the ways that his courtesan sketches actually are changing over time. What's a courtesan sketch, or what are his courtesan sketches, and what are some of the most important ways they change, and why are those changes important for the story you're telling?
Well, the courtesan sketch they can be very brief. They can be less than a page, mm-hmm. or they could be 3 pages, maybe. They're not long, and they're not fictional. They're an effort to present a courtesan in terms of what she does well, what she looks like, maybe a little bit about how he met her or how a friend met her, maybe a little bit about some romance that she was in that didn't go very well, that kind of thing. The tone of them is much more, I don't know, pessimistic or melancholy maybe than the fiction. The fiction, well, we'll get to the fiction in a minute, but even his brother's fiction, which we've already finished talking about, is very, very upbeat. And his is not, I wouldn't call the courtesan sketches upbeat. The first set of them is, I think, his best set, and I think it's just the best written. And he goes along promising that he's going to write more sets and more sets, but he only comes up, it turns out, a little bit more in this genre. But still, some of those are very interesting. He kind of interjects a reform at the beginning of the courtesan sketches. He has no interest in reform. Reform is paramount in his fiction, but not in the courtesan sketches at all. He's just enjoying their beauty and their talent, and even enjoying their melancholy and his own melancholy. I mean, it's sort of an emotional genre. It's a very old genre. And in that genre, he often quotes the work of Yuan Mei or some earlier figure. He looks back to the past in that genre pretty much. But as he moves along with a series of publications, he gets somewhat more kind of reform-minded and starts thinking of ways that the courtesan might not have to do that job at all. Maybe a poor girl could find a way to... He starts talking about maybe other ways that she could make a living for herself and wouldn't have to do this kind of work at all. So he takes on a much more moralistic attitude as he moves through the series. But at that time, the other thing that's different about the later series is that he seems to be much less connected to the city of Shanghai as he goes along. We know that from his journalistic career that he went to Beijing there was a period he worked in Beijing and then came back. And I think with that kind of community, with the courtesan community, you have to keep in good touch or else you kind of lose your connections. And I think he may have sort of lost his connections as he went along. So the second and third sets aren't as interesting as the first by any means. They're not as, well, let's put it this way. They're not as much in the genre, but they tell us maybe they show us an evolution towards a more reform-minded posture, and they give us they confirm evidence that we can find elsewhere too that he wasn't in Beijing, excuse me, in Shanghai all that time. Some time was spent. We can learn about his comings and goings as we read.
Great. And some of the really interesting things, just to kind of highlight these that come out of this chapter on courtesan sketches, is that you're showing that in the progression from the earliest to the latest of these courtesan sketches that he's doing, he also kind of transforms there's a transformation in what he's doing from writing what seems like a kind of guidebook for men to writing what's more a kind of a set of object lessons to inspire gentle women, right? And he starts portraying
there is that,
right? It's like exemplars.
That's right. That's right. He starts seeing the courtesan as someone that the gentlewoman, the aspiring gentlewoman, the woman that wants to sort of take her place on the world stage might be able to emulate, particularly toughness and not allowing yourself to be deterred if you're thrown to the ground. Just get back up and keep going. There's that sentiment comes out. And another thing that you see later on is that he uses more and more of the writings of women. Instead of writing it all himself, he sometimes uses the courtesans, not gentry women, but courtesans as commentators on the action. And that is just kind of creeping in as he goes along.
That's right. Now, some of these concerns and some of the kind of issues and these transformations that come out of the courtesan sketches also come up in his novels. And the chapter that follows this, chapter 5, looks very closely at his reformist novels. It puts two novels that are actually quite similar in plot, China's New Heroines and Women's Power, into a conversation and juxtaposes them at the beginning of the chapter. Now, these are really interesting in their own right. They're very similar. You talk about some important differences, and we might get to those. But importantly, each one is set in the future, right? Each of these novels is set 40 years in the future. I'd like to talk a little bit about that future orientation, in part because the way that John Kai treats time and space and the way that his brother treats time and space in the brother's fiction are actually kind of importantly different, and those differences turn out to have some interesting consequences. So can you talk a little bit about this future orientation in his novels, and what else for you, if anything, is important for us to note about these novels to understand how to position him in this larger story you're telling?
Well, he wants to put the novels in the future so that the evils that that John Xi talked about in his novel are no longer a factor, and he can concentrate on bringing sort of education and enlightenment to women rather than overturning old habits like foot binding. And as a result of their future orientation, they become somewhat utopian. The women heroines, it is really odd that the two novels are so close to one another in theme, but the two women heroines travel around the world and study how foreign countries carry out education for women. And when they get back, they're greeted with, well, mostly, not entirely, but mostly greeted with open arms, and the empress wants to learn from them and establishes a way that she can be in touch with these young women and their learning, and maybe even learn to read foreign newspapers. And this is going to be a way that China's women can move forward. The brother's novel was not nearly as much focused. Novels were not nearly as much focused on women. They were hardly focused on women at all, and their setting is in the past. Now, also so that's time. If we did it space, we would see. And we've already talked about that. John Xi's novel is set in Suzhou. It really, that's where it takes place. And there are a few scenes set in Shanghai, but they're not very important at all. Well, they're important in a way, but the body of it is set in Suzhou. And with John Kai's novel, the setting is a little ambiguous, but it's sort of Beijing and then international. And then they both end up in Hankou, which is where he was writing his newspaper articles from. And at the end of both of them, some statues of successful women, or maybe martyred women, are put up in the city of Hankou. That's just the way both of them end.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the really interesting things that happens here is you're showing us the, and you also bring another work called Pearls in an Azure Sea into the conversation to sort of help understand what's going on in these other two major novels. But you're showing us the similarities and differences in these works. Among the differences, are there particular approaches toward radical women and radicalism? China's New Heroines, as you show here, includes an assassination, and the other one doesn't. And there's also a greater emphasis on journalism in Women's Power. And it's relatively more gradualist. It's less kind of radical than China's New Heroines.
Right.
But there are some important similarities. Both of these works are urging women to take a greater interest in public affairs. Both of them are praising women who are strong enough to kind of recover from setbacks. And you've already talked a little bit about that. Both are paying attention to vocational education. So we see education and an interest in educational reform kind of coming out in these works. And both are engaging on some level newspapers and newspaper articles as media. And this last point brings us into the next chapter, and the last chapter that focuses on John Kai. This is a chapter that looks at his work as a journalist. And it in particular focuses on his work writing for newspapers. Now, the chapter looks very carefully at the particular kinds of positions that John Kai explored as a journalist and sort of considers how we might trace these positions, if at all, through his fictional worlds. Interestingly, his editorial writings, or at least the ones that we know about, never take up the topic of women.
Right.
So let's maybe start by talking a little about that. What kinds of topics is he writing about as a journalist? And can you talk about that, what seems to be a really interesting absence, the fact that he's not actually writing about women in his work as a journalist?
Here, I think we have to be careful because we're dealing with such a fragile set of sources that something could easily be missing. But if we, let's just say that he never wrote an editorial on women. He's much more focused, what he's really focused on in his editorials is China and China's weakness and how to help China grow so that it becomes strong again. And his methods are different from those of some other people anyway. He's great. He's a big fan of business and business education and making things easy for the business community, not just business education, business journals. He's in favor of those. He's also in favor of having the military supply a ship to follow around behind merchant vehicle. Is that what they're called? Merchant boats, so that they aren't overtaken by pirates. And just to switch back for one second, the fiance of one of the heroines of one of the two forward-looking novels, it has the job of superintending a boat that goes along behind merchant ships. So I mean, there's always a lot of crossover there, but that kind of thing is of great interest to him. And then he takes, you know, he'll pick up on a world development like the assassination of Ito Hirobumi, that kind of thing, or the shortage of food in Hangzhou and Wuhan area around the time of the revolution. But he doesn't take so far as I can tell, he doesn't take particularly radical positions. It's not as though he's pushing a revolutionary agenda, even though he lives right before the end of the Qing dynasty, right before 1911. He probably dies in 1911. But his approach seems to be gradual rather than radical. When you look at every single fact about him, you note that he did have some very radical friends. And so it's possible he had a sort of split identity. So performing on one level as a more conservative journalist and in reality acting more radical. His nephew, Zhang Xi's son, was quite a radical at that time. So I'm not going to say once and for all that he wasn't radical, but his writings in newspapers, insofar as I can see what, unless there's some irony that I'm not getting, were in favor of bringing constitutional government to China. That was one thing in which he greatly believed, but not of overthrowing the Qing.
Now, you talk in this chapter about the ways that these editorials actually help us understand the novels, right? And you put these into conversation. But at the same time, at the end of this chapter, you also alert us to some potential contradictions that emerge when you put these three types of writings that you write about of John Kai side by side. And these include, but maybe aren't limited to, his attitude toward courtesans, his stand on radical politics, and also the way that he presents himself as an author. Now, this becomes really interesting, not because I think that the book suggests that we need to definitely see him as a fundamentally contradictory figure or not, but rather, again, in juxtaposing these works and alerting us to at least potential contradictions, what the chapter is doing here and what the book is doing is making another important methodological point. You talk here at the end of this chapter about the ultimate impossibility of extracting, quote, the real John Kai, right, as we talked about a little bit earlier, from this cache of written materials. I think this is a really, really important historiographical point that I think speaks to the work that any of us does when we try to write about a single figure as a singularity, right, as an individual. All of us are juxtaposing on some level written materials and trying to extract an individual from it when we're writing about individuals. So here, I think this is a kind of exceptional case that informs the norm of what a lot of us do in what seem to be, right, more simple cases. Can you talk a little bit about that, about just kind of how you feel about that methodological historiographical problem? Because I think it is potentially so important to the work of the historian.
Well, you'll be discouraged to hear me say it, but I don't think that I can extract a real person from anything, really.
I mean, that's not discouraging. I think that's exciting. And I think that's actually, like, I agree with you. As a historian, that's what I think is so exciting about the point that you're making here. So.
I mean, even having coffee with your best friend, you know, and somehow that person might have a change of heart or something the next minute after you've left.
Completely agree with you. I'm totally on board.
But just to give one tiny example, the two reformist novels that John Kay wrote have a few, not very many, but just a few disparaging remarks about courtesans. So they'll laugh at the courtesans for trying to join other women who are talking about independence, about getting independent of men. How he laughs, can a courtesan get independent of men? But he only sort of throws that out for a minute, and I get the impression that he was probably just thinking of his audience as consisting mainly of upper class people, and just kind of threw it in. I don't think he meant it in a very deep way. Whereas when you look at how much time he spends talking about vocational education for women, he doesn't mention courtesans as the ones that will receive this education, but he has his heroines spend a lot of time thinking about how to set up schools that would help the kind of woman that in his courtesan sketches were all becoming courtesans. So I think his heart is with the effort to bring to make a better life for courtesans, or else just to let a courtesan be a courtesan and go that way. But I think, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that, given what little I know, I think I have some ways of resolving the contradictions. I don't just have to throw my hands up and say we can't make sense of this at all. But of course, if I had more material to work with, or if it weren't so remote. I mean, the Lei Ching is kind of remote, one discovers, even though it wasn't all that long ago. But working with it in as much as I did gave me some way of getting out of the contradictions that I raise. I'm not saying that I'm right, but I'm saying that there are some sort of signposts that you can follow.
That's right. But I think at the same time, by extension, even if you had a billion million other kinds of sources right at your fingertips for putting together the story that we tell about John Kay or his brother, for example, I think the really profound point that I think could emerge out of this point that we're talking about, right? You could claim, as I would actually, that as historians, we create the individuals that we write about.
I think so.
I think that's a really, really important point. I think there's a lot more to talk about there. And I just want to thank you for that chapter in particular, because I think that's something with potential wide-ranging resonance for conversation in a lot of our work, whether or not readers work on or are interested in particular on the Qing or fiction or China. So as we move toward the end of our interview, we also move toward the end of the book, and this finds us in the final chapter, chapter 7. This is a chapter that, among other things, looks closely at the important differences and similarities in the works of the brothers, and considers the potential, again, ramifications for this kind of study, for, you know, understanding how and why we might put studies of family and fiction side by side to mutually inform each other. So one of the interesting things that comes out of this chapter is something that you talk about right at the beginning, but we haven't mentioned yet in this conversation, and that is the importance of a particular link between the brothers in the figure Tang Baorong. Okay, so let's actually talk about Tang. First of all, who is this person? Why do we need a figure like this to link the brothers? And how does this person serve as this link? So can you tell us a little bit about Tang and the importance of Tang to the story that you're telling here in this part of the book?
Sure. I just thought his work was fairly close to that of Jiang Xi, but his friendship, that the demonstrable friendship, brought him close to Zhang Kai. So that's on a very simple level. Tang Barung wrote a novel called Huang Xiuqiu, which is 1905 to 1907, the same 1907 being the same time as Zhang Kai's novels. Zhang Xi's one novel was about 10 years earlier. But unlike Zhang Kai in his novel, but like Zhang Xi, Tang Barung does deal with foot binding, and it's an important ingredient in his novel. His novel is about a woman who unbound her own feet after dreaming, strangely enough, of Madame Roland, the French martyr, whom everyone associates with sort of progressiveness and radicalness. Even though I find it a little hard to do that, because she went to the guillotine on behalf of her husband. I thought that was awfully generous of her. But anyway, this Huang Xiuqiu, the heroine of the novel entitled Huang Xiuqiu, dreams of Madame Roland, unbinds her own feet, and then goes off with her husband together, and they found a school for women. The husband also founds a school for men. And it just seemed to me that this whole juxtaposition of unbinding feet and founding schools had quite a bit in common with what happened in Zhang Xi's life, but not in his novel. In his novel, the bound feet come to an end, but the school that would be founded is nowhere to be seen. But in Tang Barung's novel, the two things happen together. So that to me made an interesting link. I don't know whether there was any tie at all to Zhang Xi, but there's one possible tie in that Tang Barung's wife is known to have unbound her own feet at the age of 50. We don't know whether she dreamt of Madame Roland the night before or anything, but she's known to have done that. And that was a very unusual thing to do, unbound your own feet at the age of 50. And I think, and there's the tiniest of reasons, but I do think there is a little bit of reason to think that Zhang Xi might have borrowed that idea that he might have gone from that fact about Tang Barung to his own way of thinking about foot biting in his novel. So I'm drawing some possible links, but I see more links between Zhang Xi and Tang Barung, despite their difference in age. But I have a definite biographical link between Tang Barung and Zhang Kai, the younger brother. They had some friends in common. They had a connection to a certain newspaper, and Tang Barung actually endorsed or signed endorsements to two of Zhang Kai's courtesan sketches. So it's an awfully busy picture to try to describe to an outsider, but I felt that partly because of the age difference between the two brothers, partly because their work seems so different, partly because the mother never writes a single word to Zhang Kai, although the father does, only in his later set of poems, the ones that were never published. It was hard to make a family out of them at all. And my advisor, Professor Hannon, at first didn't believe that they were brothers until I showed him what the evidence in the local history. And then he said, okay, I guess you're right, not that. But they are rather slippery as brothers. It's a little hard to put them in the same family basket. And I just felt that having Tang Barung there helped. I also thought Tang Barung has a mother that was very important in his life that helped to educate him. And that was somewhat true of Zhang Xi. His mother and he were very close. We wrote poems to one another quite a bit. And it was Zhang Xi that helped his mother publish in the Shanbao journals. So I felt that a parallel could be drawn. It's not identical at all, but the idea of mothers with strong influences on their sons and the sons going on then to write reformist novels in the support women, maybe that would work. That's all I would say. I won't go any farther.
Great. And readers will find, or listeners when they become readers, will find lots more detail about this linkage and the potential consequences of that linkage when they turn to chapter 7 and actually read it as a text. So the chapter closes and the book closes by just echoing something that I think came out of the way you were just talking about Tang and his linkage with the brothers, and that is, it closes with a consideration of why we might want to study family and fiction side by side. And I just want to kind of mark that for listeners, again, who haven't had a chance to read the book, is that the book is not just about, and in its closing, it's not just about these particular figures. Ultimately, on another level, it's also, I think, about what it is we're doing when we study fiction, and how we might study fiction and use it to inform the way we understand family and other kinds of histories and vice versa. So this is also a book that's about what it is we're doing when we read fiction and understand it and place it in a historical frame. So, Ellen, there's a lot that we haven't had a chance to talk about, right? These chapters are full of discussions and treatments of the works that we've only very briefly talked about. They're full of other discussions as well. But given that, is there anything in particular that didn't come up in the context of our conversation but that you'd like to mention for listeners before we close?
Well, I could mention that I felt as though I was driven to write this book by a mystical force rather than by my advisor or anything that's plausible sounding. And that's only because of and you mentioned this, we were talking earlier, the cover. I happen to have a picture of a Shanghai courtesan that was in the family that almost got thrown out because my relatives didn't really approve of courtesans, that I sort of rescued from the trash. And it's quite beautiful. People have commented on it. I don't know if you saw, Kyle, I don't know if you, whether you saw the original cover or whether you just saw the coverless version.
Oh, but I have it right here with the green dress and the flowers.
It's quite striking. And I think I had this mystical feeling that maybe she had driven me to write the book, like, you know, apart from anything else we could have pointed to. But that's a little bit silly.
No, I think it actually speaks to and kind of further evokes one of the major themes in, in the book, right, is the importance of these linkages. And sometimes you're not sure
right,
whether it even exists or why, but that doesn't mean that we have to not take it into consideration or we have to ignore it when we're trying to understand the past or understand the story.
Or even just the importance, once again, as you mentioned at the very beginning, of sources and how important they are and how important the absence of them is.
Absolutely. So now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, and the cover is gorgeous, I'll reiterate that. What's next for you? What are you currently working on and inspired by?
These projects take a long, long time to germinate properly in my mind. But I had a sabbatical, not this past year, but the one before, in which I spent a lot of time actually still thinking about Huang Xiuqiu, this novel that we just finished talking about, Tang Bairong's novel, among other things. But it led me strangely to America, to a woman in America that wrote popular biographies of girls and boys. And those biographies made their way eventually to China. I can prove it to their quotations in Huang Xiuqiu from an American writer of the 19th century. And there are other ways that the American writer's work ramified into China and into Japan. I'm thinking right now, or wondering right now, whether missionary interests had any role in this transmission. I'm not sure right now. It's kind of a mystery, but that's what I'm working on.
Well, best of luck with that work, and thanks for taking time away from that to talk about this book with me. It's really been a pleasure, and congratulations again.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.